From the Sky News Centre at 5, US President Barack Obama has expressed his surprise at winning the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize. Speaking from the White House, he said he accepted the honour as a call to action for nations to confront the challenges of the 21st century. The president also described feeling humbled.
I do not feel that I deserve to be in the company of so many of the transformative figures who've been honored by this prize. Men and women who've inspired me and inspired the entire world through their courageous pursuit of peace.
A teenager who crashed her car whilst drunk, killing one of her school friends, has been jailed for 2 years and 4 months. 17-year-old Grace Hadman died in the accident in Oxford, caused by Gabriella Edmondson. The Queen and the Prime Minister have led the nation in honouring UK armed forces and civilians who served and died in Iraq. The commemoration service at St Paul's Cathedral formally marked the end of British combat operations in Iraq. A woman whose parents left their £2 million estate to the RSPCA has wept with relief after winning her legal battle to overturn the will. Christine Gill claims her father coerced her mother into making the gift. Is there water on the moon? That's what NASA's been trying to find out when it crashed two spacecraft into the lunar landscape this lunchtime. The results won't be known for a few days, but a journalist was keen to ask Anthony Colapret at the NASA news conference if he already knows.
Can't you see if there's a hydrogen oxygen flash?
Yes, you can.
Great. Was there?
I have not looked yet.
Oh, come on.
I have not.
Can you just call your buddies who are probably looking at the data right now and let us know?
And golf is back as an Olympic sport. The International Olympic Committee have voted to include it and rugby sevens in the Summer Games program from 2016. They replace baseball and softball. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. In the studio with us this week for the first hour of the show are two anti-nuclear campaigners connected with the Stop Hinkley Pressure Group. Our regular old Labour political economics expert, Martin Summers, is here too. We'll be reviewing some of the last fortnight's news stories since we had a special about the demise of the Big Green Gathering last week, as well as talking to our guests Richard Corder and Alan Pinder about the plans to build two new nuclear power stations along the Bristol Channel. Also, this week, we focus down on the leadership of the Labour Party into the next election, which is expected next May. Marina Morris has been out and about talking to you on the streets of Bristol this week about Gordon's ability or otherwise to lead Labour to victory, and also looking at David Cameron. We have an extra hour too this week, and in the second half of the show from 6 until 7, Billy Quain will be here with his reviews and giving us some ideas of free events in and around Bristol this weekend. On to our guests and discussing this week's news in a moment, but first, here's our two-week Friday drive time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures averaging 14 degrees Celsius and cloudy but dry with some sunny spells on Saturday. Next week, average of 17 degrees Celsius, that's a little bit warmer. A dry week, with the end of the week looking much warmer and sunnier. Next weekend, that's the 17th and 18th of October, averaging around 16 degrees Celsius in the daytime. A dry weekend with plenty of sun, that's next weekend, 17th and 18th of October. Week after next, averaging 15 degrees Celsius, a fairly cloudy week. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. Well, on to our guests, and with us in the studio this week are Richard Corder and Alan Pinder. Welcome to Drive Time, Alan.
Hello, Tony. Thank you. Go on.
Now, you're, I think, from round the, near the Oldbury Power Station. Can you tell me, you know, where you live and how you've been involved in the Oldbury Nuclear Power Station?
Yes, I live in Thornbury, which is just 4 miles from Oldbury, and up till recently I've been a representative of Friends of the Earth on what they call a site stakeholder group, which is a sort of a liaison between the people who work at the power station and the local community.
Now, you were involved, I think, in a protest recently that made the news. When was that and what was it about?
Well, there's talk of building a new power station next to the existing Oldbury power station, and we don't know yet whether there will be one there. There's still government decisions to be made, but the people who want to build it, E.ON, we thought were being a bit forward, and they're trying to do site drilling and all sorts of stuff that we thought before the government's even decided whether it's going to be a site.
But that's perfectly reasonable of them, isn't it? If they're thinking of possibly having a power station there, then they need to know the territory, the lie of the land.
Well, it turns out that that was indeed the case, but the local people who live right next door to it felt that they weren't being informed and that they hadn't been seen the paperwork. They weren't convinced that they didn't need planning permission. And it all needed some sorting out, really, before they should have gone on the site. And we felt that they were being a bit too in a rush and not consulting with everybody and letting everybody know what was happening.
So what did you do as part of this protest, and when was it?
Well, initially, it was a few weeks ago now, we blocked the road. We had a big bale of hay, one of these big round ones, and a banner, and there were about a dozen of us stood across the road, so they couldn't get onto the site. We didn't actually see any of them for several hours after we were expecting them. And the nuclear police, which are always a bit scary, they've got all armed police in their great big 4x4s, sort of went by and looked at us from down the road. And then eventually the local police came up and were quite friendly and acted as liaison between us and them. And we were there for a few hours arguing with them. Somebody came from E.ON to talk to us. And eventually...
But do you think you actually achieved anything by doing this?
Not very much. We got some publicity, which was good. We made them aware that they can't just trample over people. And I think the local people who had serious concerns about... They bought these houses in the countryside, and the great field next to them is going to be turned into a building site for the next 20 years. So they've got reason to be worried. So they sort of met each other, and it felt as though we'd at least registered that we were there.
Now, whereabouts are the various existing nuclear power stations around the Bristol Channel?
There's three on the Bristol Channel. There's Oldbury, as I say, which is near Thornbury, next to north of Bristol. Further on up a few miles is Barclay, and then to the south in Somerset is Hinkley Point.
Now, I'm also joined by Richard Corder. Now, Richard, if you could just lean into the microphone there a little bit. Now, you're from Bath. What's your professional background?
Well, I'm a musician. I've been a music teacher for many years, and I write music as well. I've written a few Green songs in my time. I'm sort of semi-retired now, but I can't afford to retire completely, so I still do a little bit of music teaching. And I've been involved in the Stop Hinkley campaign since the public inquiry in 1989.
So why did you feel it was necessary to get involved in 1989 then? What was it that drew you to the Stop Hinkley campaign and got you interested in these nuclear issues?
I've always been interested in pollution, I suppose, in general. And it seemed to me dangerous, knowing the effects that radiation can have after, you know, we know what happens in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, and that releasing radioactive materials into the environment on a routine basis, which is what goes on, of course, in nuclear power stations, is not a good idea. I mean, you probably remember the story of the three-headed frog on Points West a few years ago, which turned up on the beach and near Weston, I think, somewhere, and rapidly disappeared. No one knows quite what happened to it, but it was pictured on the programme. and that's the point I was pressing on at the inquiry then, that, you know, if you're releasing radioactive things into the environment that are man-made and have not been really around before in any great quantities, such as strontium-90, which mimics calcium and gets into the bones and goes bleep, 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 and gives people cancer. This is what my main concern was. It's also, of course, nuclear power is the most expensive way of boiling water that's ever been invented. Not very clever.
Now, a lot of people in the Green movement now seem to be thinking about nuclear energy as actually quite a positive thing, in that there is no carbon emission from the nuclear power stations, nothing certainly comparable to coal-fired power stations.
That's a very clever way of putting it. Of course, there's plenty of carbon involved in producing nuclear fuel, because stuff has to be mined in South Africa or Canada or Australia or wherever they get it. A lot of these mines are open cast mines that produce huge amount of radioactive pollution. Of course, there's dust spreading for miles around, and usually they don't, the mining people don't bother to clean up the environment. So there's radioactive rivers, the radioactivity gets into the groundwater, and so there's plenty of carbon emissions going on there in the machinery that they have to use to do that. So it's a bit, I think it's a bit misguiding to say that nuclear power is carbon-free in general.
Well, yes, but the nuclear industry does recycle a lot of its fuel, doesn't it? A lot of it goes up to Sellafield, is then recycled. Well, not all of the fuel that goes into the reactor is mined uranium.
Well, we remember what happened to the MOX plant, which closed down up in Sellafield, wasn't it? Well, but it was so hopelessly inefficient.
Because what the nuclear industry would argue was that actually they're being quite good recycling this fuel. It's, you know, they have a whole program that makes sure that the fuel, once it's come out of the reactor, goes up to Cumbria and then comes back down again and goes back in as brand new fuel.
In the meantime, they're shipping it around the country, of course. I mean, a friend of mine, David Taylor, a few years ago, actually managed to stop the waste train going into Barclay, I think. They actually stopped the train by putting a blockade on the line. Because shipping this stuff around the country is not a good idea, you know, if stuff has any kind of accident, of course. And there have also been stories of radioactivity being measured in the sidings where these things are parked. And they're, you know, bleeping away and emitting stuff into the...
But surely it's even more dangerous blockading and blocking a train. I mean, that's even more likely to cause an accident.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, if you're blocking a train, then maybe another train might come into the back of it
or
something. I think it doesn't sound like a particularly safe tactic.
This wasn't the main line. It was a branch line leading off to a dead end on the River Severn. So I don't think there was any danger of any train coming along and running into the back of it. But, no, I mean, the whole business of nuclear power is a sort of cloud cuckoo land dream that's been hatched by mad scientists for many years now, and it's quite flabbergasting the way that the government has thrown so much money at the nuclear industry as compared with the safe ways of producing electricity, such as wind and wave power and undersea turbines, of course, which work on tidal power, which are completely safe. But they've thrown millions of pounds, zillions of pounds at the nuclear industry. A lot of it's gone into the so-called fusion idea, which is still completely Cal Cooker land. There's no evidence that's ever going to happen. And they still keep throwing money at it. How do they do it?
So what's actually being planned then? Where are these new power stations possibly? I know that the government hasn't actually given the approval finally for it, but where might they appear?
Well, Hinkley Point is supposed to be one of the first ones, as I understand it. And, of course, the original deal was that there's going to be no subsidy for nuclear power because... was not necessary. Now EDF is actually asking the government for money, so they do want some subsidy. Whether they will get it or not, of course, is another question. And I think we can only hope maybe that we get some anti-nuclear government when they have the election next year.
Right, Richard, thank you. Now, Martin Summers is joining us too. He's our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Martin, what are your views on the economics of nuclear power?
Well, I think that Richard has just put his finger on it. In actual fact, nuclear power has never been viable as a private sector free market exercise. That doesn't mean that it's not that you can't do it. I mean, if you wanted to do it, you can. I mean, I don't believe necessarily that things have to be entirely freestanding free market organisations in order to be allowed to exist. But nevertheless, nuclear power is very, very expensive, and I remember writing a paper about this in the 90s when the then Conservative government wanted to privatise the nuclear industry, and it gradually became clear, as private sector financial people looked at the books, that they weren't in any way interested, especially if they had to take responsibility for the insurance risks of the waste. Now, if this is the case, then what we are actually saying is we're going to have more nuclear power stations, but we are going to pay for them through general taxation one way or another. We're already paying an enormous levy to the nuclear industry to look after the existing waste and infrastructure. And what I would say to anybody who's a nuclear scientist, like John Large, who it used to be, and others like him, is that there's going to be plenty of jobs for nuclear engineers for many generations to come, making sure that all this stuff is safely mothballed. But there's absolutely no reason to go any further down this road. I find it extraordinary that the Labour government at this stage of the political cycle has suddenly decided that it wants to go for nuclear power.
So what's your theory? You're saying it's extraordinary. I mean, is it the lobbying power of the nuclear industry?
I think it's the lobbying power of the industry. It's what you do with something like nuclear power, it was only really developed as a way of trying to make some money out of nuclear weapons. That's really how nuclear power comes about, and that's the same in most countries. And of course, then of course, once you've created this infrastructure that's full of people whose careers depend on it, and so on and so forth, they then become a lobby for more of the same. And people say that this is the sort of thing that happens with any government program. That's what free market economists suggest. Well, in this case, they might well be right.
Thanks, Martin. Right, more about the new local nuclear power stations that may possibly be built around the Bristol Channel. I nearly say in the Bristol Channel, but that's probably not the best term, later in the programme. But first, let's have a look at some of this week's news stories over the last couple of weeks. First, we start with the HSBC boss warning of a second global economic downturn. That was in the Daily Mail on the 6th of October. The head of Britain's biggest bank has warned we could soon be heading into a second recession. Michael Jürgen, I'm not quite sure if that's a correct way to pronounce it, of HSBC says he has delayed expansion plans at his bank because he fears the upturn could be short-lived. I think we better start with you, Martin, on this one.
Well, I think he's probably right. I find it quite extraordinary that people are talking about an upturn because we haven't actually seen any upturn apart from in stock markets. All the other indicators are firmly pointing downwards. This upturn, this green shoots of recovery, has been very much an a bubble in the stock market rather than in the real economy. And I think once governments stop stimulating the economy, as they will have to do, because their budget deficits are getting so big, then we will go back into seriously downturn, recession, depression, whatever you want to call it.
Surely, Martin, the stock market just reflects what's going on in the outside economy. If a company's doing well, its shares go up.
Patently, it does not, because the real economy is going down while the stock market is going up. And I don't think you could get a better example of the parasitic nature of what the financial industry has become. And the problem is that when people say, well, where has all this extra spending gone, all the quantitative easing and the TARP money in the US and all the rest of it, well, it's gone into this stock market bubble. There it is. That's all that's happened to it. The money has been taken by the insider players. They've pumped up another bubble, and that bubble will now burst, and they will walk away with the money. And this is not this is no way to run a railroad.
Richard and Alan, would you like to comment on that first?
Yes, I would. There is a theory that the recession was in part, at least, caused by rising oil prices, because we're just about hitting peak oil, which means that oil production is going down at the same time as oil demand is going up, which, of course, is a classic scenario for rapidly rising prices. And we saw that a year ago, or whenever it was. Oil prices started to go through the roof, and it's only the recession that's caused that to level out and become more sensible again. As soon as the economy picks up, we would expect oil demand to go up, oil prices will therefore go through the roof, and we will get another recession.
Over to you then, Richard.
Right, I don't have a lot to say to add really to what's been said, except that I'm quite angry with something that appeared in The Independent a couple of days ago, which says that despite the fact that the wholesale fuel prices have been coming down very fast recently, the fuel companies are still charging the same as they were 6 months ago, and my fuel bills are becoming alarmingly big. And I think the government doesn't have enough control over the way these things are regulated. I gather the fuel companies can run rings around the regulator,
Well, we'll be talking more about that actually a bit later on. Martin's going to come in here.
Can I just comment on that? I mean, there is obviously peak oil, and that is obviously a long-term pressure on the economic system. But don't forget that the speculation in oil markets is enormous. So that you get these huge volatile swings in the price of crude oil. And this has nothing to do with supply and demand, but it's more to do with the creation of bubbles. And this is because the economy is over-financialized. Things like oil should be actually regulated by buffer stocks and things of this sort, so that everybody knows what the price is going to be over a long-term period. We can plan, and we can decide how much we want to use and how to reduce our use and so on. But we've actually, it's not just that we're running out of oil, it's also that then the market in oil is cornered by speculators, and they push the price through the roof and then collapse the bubble. And we've seen this in lots of different markets, commodity markets, all sorts of markets. And this volatility of financial markets is the root of a lot of the problems we face. And we've got to get back to a more regulated setup.
Well, staying with the international economy, the demise of the dollar. This is an article, front page of The Independent on Tuesday this week by Robert Fisk. In the most profound financial change in the recent Middle East history, Gulf Arabs are planning, along with China, Russia, Japan and France, to end dollar dealings for oil, moving instead to a basket of currencies, including the Japanese yen and Chinese yuan, the euro, gold and a new unified currency, which is being planned for the nations in the Gulf Cooperative Council, including Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Kuwait and Qatar. Right, you kick off on this, Martin. Is the dollar really, is that the last we're going to see of it in these as an international currency?
This article, I was reading on the internet today, that this article has actually had quite a big effect in the markets, and has caused quite a degree of panic, and people have been saying, well, where did Fisk get his information? I think it's quite likely that countries are looking to diversify out of the dollar, because the dollar is basically in massive oversupply. There's huge government and trade deficits in the US, and eventually there is going to be a run on the dollar.
So historically, why is it that the dollar is the currency which is used for this kind of thing?
Because it was put in place at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1946. If you can imagine, at that stage, America was the only country in the world that hadn't been devastated by World War II. Japan was wrecked, Germany was wrecked. And so the US was in a position to say, right, we're going to set up a new system. And the dollar was supposedly linked to gold, which meant that the US government couldn't abuse their position as printer of the world's currency, if you like, because it was linked to gold. But in 1972... because they wanted to carry on fighting in Vietnam, but they couldn't afford it, they took the dollar off gold. Nixon took the dollar off gold, and so the Vietnam War and the loss of the Vietnam War led to the dollar becoming a free-floating currency, and a lot of our problems have started at that point.
So is Robert Fisk being a bit naughty here, stirring the markets up?
I think if he's got genuine information, it's genuine information, isn't it? I mean, you can say that he's spreading rumours or whatever. I mean, everybody knows that the US dollar must be replaced by something else. The question is, what? The euro, a basket of currencies, and of course this is where all the geopolitical arguments come in. Who's going to have the big say over the new currency that will come into place as the world's reserve currency? And of course the US will fight tooth and nail to keep the existing setup, because they are actually, they're able, for example, to expand their government expenditure without worrying too much about inflation, because they print the world's reserve currency. Everybody else is getting a bit fed up with it.
Alan?
I agree wholeheartedly with what Martin says. The American boom that we've seen, and the enormous consumption that they have over there, is funded by the dollar being a reserve currency, and it's all being paid for by the Chinese and the people in the Far East. And the sooner that situation gets sorted out, the sooner we'll be able to sort out the world's environmental problems.
Well, it's been a Conservative Party conference week, and the savagery of Santa was the headline in The Guardian on Wednesday this week from Simon Hoggart. He's looking at George Osborne's speech, saying that when the Conservatives get in, they're going to straighten the national economy up, apparently, and there's going to be cuts. Martin, what are your thoughts on Simon Hoggart's take or on George Osborne's speech?
Well, Simon Hoggart is an entertainer rather than a journalist, and it's quite amusing. I mean, as he's saying here, and then we're off hurtling down the highway of hopelessness, stopping up at the welcome break of woe for checking into Misery Motel. I mean, that's Simon Hoggart's style. But I think that this is quite an important point, that the Conservative Party, both Cameron and Osborne, have nailed their colours to the mast this week, saying that they are going to cut public expenditure. And all I can say to that is just wrong. That is not the thing to do at this moment. Japan tried to do this in the early 90s when they had similar problems, and they simply pushed themselves into a decade of deflation. If there is a problem with investors not wanting to buy British Treasury bills, you should do one of two things. You should either make your own money so that you don't have to borrow money to spend it. Governments can do this, although people forget that they can. Or secondly, if there is a problem with British Treasury bills, then you have to close the deficit down a bit. But the way to do that is to take money off the wealthy who don't spend it and give it to the poor who do. So what we're really talking about, if you want to balance the budget, is raise taxes on those who've made money out of the bubble. Now, that's not what they're saying. What they're saying is they're going to cut public expenditure. If they do, I guarantee that the economy, as in the 80s, will go down, and they will stop doing it because the automatic stabilisers will kick in. Margaret Thatcher thought she was going to cut public expenditure in 1981. She didn't. Public expenditure increased because of all the dole payments that had to be made for all the people who'd been kicked out of work. And that is what will happen. So this is fantasy land, and I think it suggests that they're not actually fit to run the country.
Well, that's pretty strong stuff. Alan, what do you think about George Osborne's speech and the whole sort of conservative approach to the economy?
I'm with Martin. I'm not a Labour Party supporter by any means, but it's certainly they're making a mountain out of this, presumably just because they're trying to say something in opposition. They haven't really got a lot of proposals to put forward, but the idea that you should face what we're going through at the moment, the downturn in the economy, by cutting expenditure is absurd. And the only reason Mrs. Thatcher got away with it was because she was funded by North Sea Oil, which is now drying up. And since that money is no longer there, they're facing bankruptcy.
But surely George Osborne here is just simply trying to make sure the books balance, like any good businessman would with his business. I mean, he's applying the same kind of logic to the country. I mean, Martin talks about the idea of printing more money. Well, it's generally accepted that by doing that, if you can do that to a certain extent, but if you do it too much, you're going to get massive runaway inflation. Martin, do you want to just answer that point? This is what I'm sure George Osborne would be saying if you were to tell him to print more money.
I would say that the underlying theory of inflation, which is implied by what George Osborne is saying, is simply wrong. There's not much of a danger of inflation when you've got 10% unemployment and falling commodity prices and deflation. We haven't had a situation of deflation in Britain since the 1930s, and people therefore don't understand, perhaps, what the implication of it is. There is no real danger of inflation as we speak. Although, of course, you can't just keep printing money, that's right. And, of course, why are we printing money? To rescue the private banking system. That's the reason why we haven't got any money for schools, hospitals, or even foreign wars.
No, surely the money is being printed in order to keep the economy going. So that's actual real money that's in the economy, isn't it?
No, the money is being printed through quantitative easing, and also public money is being pushed into the banks to keep them solvent. I don't think they should be wasting money trying to keep the existing financial sector solvent. What you should do is actually allow that sector to be unravelled in an orderly fashion, basically closed down, existing management sacked, and you move towards a much, much more controlled financial system. Now, nobody is actually saying this, apart from me, of course, on this programme. but, I mean, this is not the official position of the Labour Party either, and I think that they have to do some thinking about this situation as well, because we are not going back to the old-style private sector-run financial system. It is simply bankrupt and finished. And we've had Liberal Democrats on this programme and others who are saying, well, we've got to regulate the private financial system. And I simply say to them, there is no private financial system. It's not a question of regulating a private financial system. It's a question of trying to rethink a publicly run system. What would that look like? How would we want it to work?
Well, we'll be hearing a little bit more about David Cameron, hot foot from the Conservative Party conference, in a minute, from Marina Morris. Now, Marina Morris is joining me now. Hi, Marina. What have you got up for us this week?
We will talk about background of the Labour and Conservative parties. Today, I would like to wish David Cameron a happy 33rd birthday. David William Duncan Cameron was born on 9th of October 1966 in London. The son of a stockbroker, he spent the first 3 years of his life in Kensington and Chelsea before the family moved to an old rectory near Newbury in Berkshire. His great-great-great-grandfather, William Mount, was Conservative MP for the Isles of Wight in the 19th century. Mr. Cameron's great-great-grandfather, also called William Mount, sat for Newbury before passing the seat on to his son Sir William Mount, the first baronet and David Cameron's great-grandfather. After prep school, David Cameron followed in the family tradition and went to Eton. He went to Oxford to study philosophy, politics and economics. After gaining a first-class degree, Mr. Cameron answered to advertisement for a job in the Conservative Research Department. He progressed quickly through the ranks and was soon briefing Minister for Media Appearance. By the early 1990s, Mr. Cameron has decided he wanted to be an MP himself, but he also knew it was vital to gain experience outside of politics. So, after a brief spell as an advisor to then Home Secretary Michael Howard, he took a job in public relations with ITV television company Carlton. In 2001, he won the saved Conservative seat in Witney in Oxfordshire. Mr. Cameron was by now a marriage man with a family. His wife Samantha grew up on the 300-acre Normandy Health Estate. Her stepfather, Viscount Astor, was a minister in John Major government, with responsibility for broadcasting. With his influential friends and blue-blooded heritage, Mr. Cameron has been criticized for not being in touch with ordinary people. But his easy money and confidence in front of the television cameras allows him to appear, if not exactly classless, then not the upper-class figure his background might suggest. James Gordon Brown was born in February 1951, the second son of a Church of Scotland minister. By the age of 12, working for the Labour Party by distributing leaflets. At the age of 16, he had joined his older brother John at Edinburgh University, the youngest student there since 1945. During the first week of term, then he was diagnosed with a detached retina, thought to be the result of being kicked in the head during an end-of-term rugby match at school. He lost the sight in one eye, retaining 30% of his vision in other. In his second year, he became the editor of the student magazine, grabbing national headlines by exposing the university's investment in pro-apartheid South Africa. After university, he lectured in politics in Glasgow College of Technology, becoming a major figure in the Scottish Labour Party. After his spell as a television journalist and producer for STV in Glasgow, he won the Safe Labour seat in Dunfermline East at the 1983 general election at the age of 32. A few weeks after entering the Commons, Brown began sharing an office with another new boy, Tony Blair, a 30-year-old Islington barrister. The pair's potential was spotted by Labour leaders Neil Kinnock, who promoted them into his shadow cabinet. When shadow chancellor John Smith died in 1994, Blair and Brown found themselves pitted against each other's potential rivals for the party leadership. In exchange for giving him a clear run at the leadership, Mr. Blair promised he would make Brown the most powerful chancellor in the history, this unprecedented control over domestic policy. The goal that united them in the 1990s was to get Labour into power after 18 years in opposition. As Blair entered down street on a wave of public optimism, Brown went into action as the Treasury, granted control of interest rates to the Bank of England and freezing public spending for 2 years. Brown set about taking away powers from other departments as he extended the reach of the Treasury into nearly every area of domestic policy. Decisions that might ordinarily have been expected to be made by Prime Minister were being made at the Treasury. Politically, Brown achieved what many has thought impossible and gave Labour a reputation for sound economic management, including tight control over public spending. Then Blair announced he was standing down. Brown's total dominance of the Labour leadership was clear. As Prime Minister during the last 3 years, his control over public spending is now being challenged. This record public deficit financed by state borrowings. But what do the people of Bristol think about the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown?
Yes, what indeed. Let's have a listen to this week's Vox Pops, Marina.
Do you trust Gordon Brown, and do you think he's the right person to lead his party into the next election?
No, not at all. I'll tell you why not, because he got rid of the 10 pence tax rate, and I think he did it simply because the Tories frightened him a couple of weeks before it when they made the switch in inheritance tax. And in order to try and get back up in the polls, he took money from the poor to give it to the rich. So I come from a working class background. I voted Labour all my life. I would never vote for Gordon Brown, because either he knew what he was doing, in which case he was wicked, or he didn't know what the knock-on effect would be, in which case he's stupid. Either way, I can't vote for such a man. By leading them, it's certain that they'll lose, and they deserve to lose.
Yes, I do. I think he's a man who's dedicated his life to economics, and I trust him with the money. Yeah, I trust him. He hasn't got the charisma that Cameron's got, but he's dedicated to dealing with the money of the country, and I think he's going to get it right. Yeah. Because it's about money. At the end of the day, it's all down to money, isn't it? Get out of Afghanistan, get out of Iraq, and dedicate, completely not worry and business himself about this special relationship with America. Forget America. Let's get closer to Europe. Let's embrace Europe and keep to the program that he's dedicated to regarding the financial crisis that we're in. He can just keep on track what he's doing. The amount of money, I've got someone in my family who's seriously ill and has been in hospital for over 2 years. And the help and the dedication from the nurses and the facilities of that hospital has been fantastic. I can't see how anybody can complain about the money that's been pumped into schools and hospitals and everything else. I just think they should just carry on track. And, you know, maybe more of his members should be trying to help promote him and his skills, not his looks, not his three different hairstyles like Cameron and the Eton Mafia, the public school boys. Stick to the program that they've been sticking to, and just hopefully things will make itself right.
I would say that he's probably a man in a very difficult position. Public opinion is always against whoever's in charge. So he's probably been given a very difficult set of circumstances and issues to deal with. He's certainly doing his best. Whether or not he's entirely trustworthy in that probably would go back to whether any person in power really is. I don't know if I particularly trust Gordon Brown, given the facts. That would be my opinion.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I don't trust anyone in politics anymore at all, so... Trusting Gordon Brown, no. Trusting any of them, no.
Now, that's an interesting question, because Gordon Brown is sort of... for me, he's always lacked charisma. One thing about Blair, whatever you could say about Blair, he was a leader of men, I think, and that's one thing for me Gordon Brown massively lacks. If the Labour Party's going to have any chance going forward, they're going to need someone who's a charismatic, realistic leader. For me, Gordon Brown, it just hasn't got that charisma that you need to be a leader. So no, I wouldn't say so.
Yeah, I never thought I'd say it, but bring back Tony Blair. If Labour's to go forward, I think everyone's lost so much confidence in Gordon Brown that definitely, certainly, something needs to change with Labour.
No, not at all. He's been in power too long and it's time for a change. I can't really think of anybody better, to be honest. Not that there's anybody probably better in the Conservatives, but I can't think of anybody at all in the Labour Party at all. Not at the moment.
Not particularly, but then he's as bad as all the rest of the politicians. They're only interested in one thing, and that's running their own pockets.
Do you trust Gordon Brown?
Yeah, I trust him. It's the rest of them. Well, I think it's Blair that's made this blooming country in the state it's in, not poor Gordon Brown. He's getting the blame for it. Well, I'm not going to vote Labour. I'm going to vote Conservative. Because I think we've got to get this government out.
I trust Gordon Brown. Okay. I think he's genuine.
Well, first off, we're not English. We're American.
I trust him as much as I trust Barack Obama.
Who do you think will win the next election?
I think Gordon Brown get back in.
Conservatives, I think. Well, I think everybody wants a change.
I think it's absolutely certain that the Conservatives will win it, but it leaves me with no one to vote for, because I would never vote for the Conservatives. I don't think they'll be any better. I think they only care about the rich, which is a real tragedy of the situation. The party that should be caring for the working poor hasn't done. They care to, they've increased the gap between the rich and the poor in the 12 years in power, and I think that that's a disgrace, and it's treacherous to their class.
If Conservatives get in, I'll personally be devastated. The building site I've just left, nearly everyone is reading the Sun newspaper and is supporting David Cameron because they don't understand the deeper programme.
Well, that's just it. There is time between now and then, and in the world of politics, I think very much that things can change on a daily basis, so it's an impossible question. Labour today, certainly the press, the people seem to be against them. Going forward, they may be loved, maybe. Stranger things have happened.
Who is the most trusted British politician?
I don't think there's a single politician you can trust in Britain. Even Vince Cable, that they try and persuade us, can be trusted. I think all of them, I think they're too interested now in sound bites. They're too interested in how they look on television and how it plays in the short term. I think very few of them have got any principles, and I think the expenses scandal just proved that.
Yeah, I've got one personally, Keir Faz.
I know it's a cliche sort of answer, but I think Churchill probably was one politician I genuinely would have trusted, purely because his heart was for the country, always, whatever happened to the end, whatever that may be. So, Churchill, certainly.
Ever.
Winston Churchill.
Yeah, Gordon Brown.
Yeah, some interesting comments there. Maybe we could start with you, Martin. What are your thoughts about what we heard there? Because it was pretty much a balance, wasn't there? Some people saying no confidence at all, but a few all really having total confidence in Brown, thinking he's the guy who's the best person to be running the country's economy.
Well, I think what's interesting about that, there's hardly any positive, very positive expression of opinion about the Conservative Party. We've got a whole spectrum of opinion there by people who are either disillusioned with the Labour Party or still confident that they can get something from them. I mean, this is Bristol, of course. We're not out in the shires. I think that the problem for the Labour Party, and you know, as a Labour activist, I would tell you this, is that the core vote of the Labour Party is soft, very soft. Because people feel that the party has not done the things that it ought to have done and has done the things that it ought not to have done. And it's very, very hard to get that confidence and trust back. Things like the Iraq war, the increasing gap between rich and poor, the sort of non-Labour things that have been done. Under a PR system, the Labour government would have to take account of its inner-city base. Under a first-past-the-post system, they can ignore their inner-city base to try and win suburban seats. And that, of course, leads to a great deal of disillusionment for those who have always traditionally looked to the party.
But most of the people, many of the people there were saying, really, they didn't trust hardly any of the politicians. And it's amazing, sort of looking back to Churchill as somebody that they trust. You know, this
Churchill was hoofed out unceremoniously in 1945 by the British electorate. Mm. They liked what he'd done in the war, but they weren't going to let him run the health service. Yeah. And that's democracy.
OK, Alan, you've been a Green politician, I think, in your time, haven't you? What are your thoughts on what you've just heard about Gordon Brown there?
Yeah, it's very, very interesting to hear what people think. On the whole, he was a very good chancellor, and people liked him as a chancellor, but he hasn't got the right look, really. I mean, politics is all about what you look like, about image. And he just doesn't look like a prime minister, whereas David Cameron's got—he's so smooth, he looks like a double glazing salesman, doesn't he?
But is it really just about charisma? Is that what people vote for?
I would be very surprised. For most people, I mean, I've done a lot of knocking doors in my time, and people haven't got the foggiest idea what the issues are at all. Most people, they've got a little bit of sort of. If you vote for the Conservatives, it's better for your wallet, and if you vote for the Labour Party, it's better for jobs or better for the health service, something like that. And I don't know that that's any of that is true anymore. I mean, they've been throwing all these issues up in the air and forgotten all of them.
So what does it say if we're voting for people, not policies?
Well, I would agree with most of the people in the Vox Pop that you can't really trust any of them. And I've no idea what David Cameron would do if he got in. And I wouldn't trust Gordon Brown any further than I could throw him.
OK, Richard, have you got any thoughts on what we've just heard, our Vox Pops
yes,
there?
Yes, I find it rather depressing that I don't think anyone really mentioned the Liberals very much. And Vince Cable is the person who's the most outstanding economist in the political scene at the moment. He's predicted most of the trouble that we've been seeing.
Well, to be fair, that was actually specifically about Gordon Brown, and there were a few spin-offs of it, yes. I so see. That's why we didn't hear the Liberals. Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. Good. Okay. Well, I shall mention him again. The best outcome I'm looking for the next election is that we have a hung parliament with the Liberals holding the balance of power, and then we might get PR coming in. But I also wanted to pick up on the chap who mentioned the Eton Mafia at the heart of the Conservative Party, and I have to say I'm very disappointed that Zach Goldsmith, the editor of the Ecologist magazine, has apparently put the Old Boy Network above his ecological principles, and I'm thinking he's going to find it very hard to live with the Tories if they do get into power. He has said that if they don't take his advice, he'll quit. So I hope that may happen rather rapidly.
Yeah, but doesn't it make sense? I mean, if he thinks the Conservatives are going to win, it makes sense to be part of the winning team.
Yes, but I think he is already beginning to fear that they won't take his advice. He's a sort of trophy that they've, like this new general they've attracted to their team. He's a trophy who, you know, is the green trophy. But I think he's going to find it very difficult to get his eyes put his ideas put forward once they're in power.
One of the other news stories this week, in fact, is a TV drama that's been on More 4, and I think it's later going to be on. It's a drama later be on Channel 4. Is this drama called When Boris Met Dave? It was an article in the Daily Mail on the 10th Saturday about it. The Bullingdon Club. This is looking at. It says he has cast himself as a future Prime Minister who understands the hopes and needs of ordinary Britons, which is why David Cameron would rather have us forget his exploits as a member of Oxford University's elitist society, the Bullingdon Club. But a new Channel 4 docudrama charting one of the most embarrassing periods of the Conservative leader's past is airing on the eve of an all-important speech to next week's Tory party conference. Now, Richard, do you think it's a coincidence that More 4 are screening this drama at the same time as the Conservative conference? And what are your thoughts on it? I don't know if you saw it, did you?
No, it's gone, is it? Oh dear, no.
No, it's actually on. It's actually also on Saturday at 10 p.m. and Sunday at 1:40 a.m. on More 4.
Yes. Okay. Well, Boris is a very interesting phenomenon, isn't he? He's certainly very telegenic, and studied way that he brushes his hair back and makes his ridiculous gestures is...
But he's got charisma, so this is why people vote for him, isn't it?
But he's also a complete loon, isn't he? I mean...
I don't know. I don't think it's fair to say he's a loon, is it, really? Because he's actually got the support of the London electorate.
He has, yes. And poor old Ken was ditched because of the Boris charisma, I suppose. I've forgotten where this is going.
Anyway, let's look briefly again at the programme. It takes on this drama. It takes its inspiration from the black and white picture of the 10-strong Bullingdon Club, featuring both Cameron and Johnson at Oxford in 1987, dressed up in waistcoat and tails. That's David Cameron and Boris Johnson. The Tory leader has gone to great lengths to play down his membership of this 150-year-old Bullingdon Club. But, I mean, this just... Because you've brought up all this stuff about Boris. It just seems to me that the guy has actually got some sort of stage presence, and this is why people vote for him. I think it's just unfair of you to say this is some sort of lunacy. He's got the gift of the gab, hasn't he? And isn't that what we want in politicians?
No, absolutely not. We want people to tell the truth and tell us what's going to happen.
Well, we've just heard from the Vox Pops that people are voting a lot for what they see as charisma rather than going into the detail of the policies.
This is the tragedy of modern politics, that all this television glamour and glitter and stuff, like the dancing show, it's all about superficial rubbish. Pardon me.
Okay, Martin, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, as an ex-Oxford man myself, but not a member of the Bullingdon Club, I have to say that this very narrow social base of the current Conservative leadership is a source of worry, although I think that their determination to be seen to be more demotic and in tune with ordinary people is probably quite a good thing. But I'm afraid we really are going back to the Grouse-Moore theory of national leadership. I can't see anything new here. We've had a massive financial crisis caused by the free markets, which the Conservatives allowed to happen after the 1987 Big Bang, when these chaps were still in university. I don't see any sign that they've taken on board the seriousness of this crisis.
Listen, it's not fair to just blame the Conservatives, isn't it? The Labour Party have been in power since 1997 and have done nothing about it.
All the political forces have been enthralled to this free market ideology, and that's what it is, it's ideology. Brian Gould, who was a Labour MP and activist and one of the founders of New Labour, he said in the 1980s, unless we're prepared to take on the City of London, we might as well give up and go home. And John Smith and others started to lead the Labour Party into a modus vivendi with the City of London. That has now turned out to be a fatal error. Absolutely fatal. And what but we really need to see from our politicians now is, what are you going to do about the sewer that is the City of London?
Isn't it fair to say that they probably wouldn't, New Labour would probably not have got elected unless they'd got come to these arrangements with the City back in 1996, 97?
Obviously, you have to deal with these people, but you have to deal with them in a robust fashion. That's got to be the philosophy. You can't have the government of the day, which is responsible for the well-being of the population, kowtowing to people who don't really have the best interests of the rest of the community at heart. There's got to be a change in the balance of power. And this is one of the reasons why people find politics boring and irrelevant. It's because the important issues like who's going to actually sort this out are not dealt with. It's all presumed that it's somebody else will deal with it. When I lived in Poland, we saw Solidarity replaced by the former communists, replaced by the far right, replaced by the moderate right. So you had a full spectrum of electoral victories in Poland. The economic policy remained the same: privatisation, deregulation, liberalisation. That whole philosophy, which has underpinned everything for the last 30 years, is just out of date. And what I want to see from all political leaders, if the Conservatives are going to win the next election, it's going to be, the ball is going to be in their court. How are you going to regulate the financial markets? Give us the detail.
Okay, so let's just recap this programme. When Boris Met Dave is on More 4, and it will be later on broadcast on Channel 4. It's all about the Bullingdon Club in Oxford, and that is on this Saturday, that's the 10th of October at 10 p.m. on More 4, and Sunday, the 11th of October, at rather late, at 1:40 a.m. Maybe, Martin, you could just finish by telling us a bit more about this Bullingdon Club. Was it something you were aware of when you were in Oxford?
You can only be recruited to it if you are chosen by those that are already members.
So you weren't chosen?
I don't think I was.
Is there a little bit of bitterness there?
I think I'd have been absolutely appalled if they'd made any attempt to recruit me to it. I mean, Oxford has 12,000 students at any one time, and when I was there, which I left in 1980, it was the year when they had the highest proportion of state school pupils. It's since dropped back. And that was about 50%. But there was very big difference between those who'd come from state schools and those who hadn't. And it made a big difference to the kind of friends you had and the sort of things you did. I did the same degree as David Cameron, though. I did politics, philosophy and economics.
So did you? Yes, but surely this is the sort of thing that all students want to do, is get involved in high japes and drinking. And this is what apparently the Bullingdon Club gets
up
to.
So did we, but we didn't dress up in silly clothes to do it.
Okay. Right, well, let's get back to the plans for possible nuclear new build around the Bristol Channel. As we've been talking to Richard Corder and Alan Pinder about this, Alan, could you just start off by telling us, are these power stations, the new power stations, going to be built or not? What's your thoughts on that?
It's looking a lot less likely than it was a few months ago, but it's still frightening me. I mean, I'm so near to it that it every time I wake up in the morning.
So why is it looking less likely?
It's looking less likely partly because of because nuclear power is so expensive. It's partly because of the recession. So there's a lot less money about, and the banking crisis. So there's nobody really with the sort of money that's needed to build a nuclear power station. So the people who are planning to do that are E.ON and EDF, which are French and German German and French respectively, backed almost public utilities. And so because they're government backed, they don't need, they're not quite so squeezed as the rest of us are.
And also we've heard that a lot of these continental economies are now starting to come up, so it may be that they can ignore the British recession and just get on and build these power stations anyway.
Exactly. And I mean, one of the reasons, the one at Oldbury particularly, E.ON, who want to build that one, they, the change of government in Germany may well mean that the Germans will pick up with nuclear power again, in which case they will be much more interested in building power stations in Germany than they will in this country.
Now, Richard, can I just get your thoughts on this? Because I notice you brought with you today James Lovelock's book, which is The Revenge of Gaia. Now, James Lovelock is a green thinker who has really been at the forefront of pushing the idea that nuclear may be the best green option. So, I mean, have you read this book here? You look maybe like you're halfway through it. What do you think of Lovelock's views?
As I rushed out of the house, I was looking for Helen Caldicott's book on nuclear issues, which has the most fantastic list of statistics on why it's a bad idea, and I couldn't find it, and I happened to pick that one up instead.
So that's a pro-nuclear book. Yes.
I've written to James Lovelock. I think, how can you go down this nuclear path when you're such a green person? You believe in the Gaia principle and...
What he's saying is essentially that it's actually overall less pollution and better for the planet, especially in these days of global warming, climate change and all that kind of thing, that there's very little effect on the environment, at least on the atmosphere, from nuclear, whereas the coal-fired power stations, the gas power stations, all using massive amounts of fossil fuels, are really what's responsible for this climate chaos.
There's something in that. But it doesn't, you know, what you're ignoring is the pollution problem. As I said before, the whole mining, the uranium mining is an absolute nightmare for wiping out whole large areas of the earth from radioactive pollution. And of course the regular discharges. We haven't talked yet about the fact that it seems, according to Professor Chris Busby's new theory of how radiation works in the body, that that the way it's been the dangers have been measured since the beginning of 1950 or whenever it was have been wrong, largely because the doses were decided by physicists rather than biologists. And the neat little analogy that he makes is that you can measure radiation as like thinking you're sitting in front of a nice warm glowing fire of coals. That corresponds to the gamma radiation that will pass straight through you, as it did in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Or you can think about the alpha and beta particles, which are lying around in the mud and in the water and can get blown inland, and you can breathe them in. That is like taking a live coal out of the fire and swallowing it, and you can see the difference immediately. And now the current methods of measuring the dangers of radiation do not take account of the alpha and beta particles that you can ingest into your body and will carry on bleeping away for years.
So aren't you just a bit of a Luddite standing in the way of the clean, new, efficient energy methods?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, Alan, can you just tell us what sort of power stations they're talking about building? I think we've got already advanced gas cool reactors and Magnox, I think, in the area. What about these new ones that they're talking about?
Yeah, the existing Oldbury one is a Magnox. The E.ON have got two different designs in mind. There's the Westinghouse AP1000 or the European Areva design. They're both much, much bigger than anything we've seen in this country before. The current Oldbury power station generates that's an interesting story, but it generates about 450 megawatts, whereas we're talking about the new power station would be 1,600 megawatts, so something like 3 to 4 times as big.
Okay, but there is also, of course, the fact that this will create loads of new employment, much-needed employment in your area. Now, if you can just, for a moment, ignore the environmental impact, I mean, surely that there is at least something positive to say about that.
I've not seen figures about how many people they will employ. It's a big construction job, of course, but these construction jobs don't use as many people as they once did. But the current power station employs 400 people, which is tiny compared with the number of people who work in office blocks and so on all around the Bristol North Fringe. And there was some discussion of what would happen to the people who work at the current Oldbury Power Station when it closes down. And it was considered as so tiny that it wasn't a problem, that it would all get soaked up by British Aerospace and Rolls-Royce and all these other places. And engineers are in such short supply that they will find plenty of jobs elsewhere.
OK, now it's time for the Sky News at 7. We say goodbye to our guests. That's now time for the Sky News at 7. We're back in a few minutes with music, news and reviews in our State of the City Hour.